Carol Emshwiller, Ledoit. First published in 1997, revised in 2002, and revised again for this book. Looking over the new fiction shelf at the library one day in 1997, I saw Ledoit by Carol Emshwiller. Emshwiller? I thought, my Emshwiller? She wrote a new book that's been out for 2 years and I never heard about it. I shouldn't have been surprised. Emshwiller's readers know her to be a major fabulist, a marvelous magical realist, one of the strongest, most complex, most consistently feminist voices in fiction. But her books, mostly published by a good small press in San Francisco, Mercury House, don't get wide attention. Part of the problem may well be her calm originality. Most reviewers prefer pigeons that fit in holes and rabbits that redux. Emshwiller is like a wild mixture of Italo Calvino, Intellectual Games, and Grace Paley, Perfect Honesty, and Faye Weldon, Outrageous Wit, and Jorge Luis Borges, Pure Luminosity. But no, her voice is perfectly her own. She isn't like anybody. She's different. Before I get to Ledoit, which is different, I want to talk a little about the other Emshwiller books, which are all different. Before 1990, I knew her work only from science fiction publications. She isn't categorizable as an SF writer, but she knows how to play brilliant games with SF themes. Verging on the Pertinent, from Coffee House Press, 1989, the first of her books I read is a collection of fables, witty, cool, scary. After reading it, I thought of her as an impressive and sophisticated writer whom I admired without exactly liking, though I did love the first story in the collection, Yukon, about a woman in the far north who runs away from her husband and spends the winter comfortably with a bear and then meets her true love, who is an Engelmann spruce tree, or a man very like a spruce tree named Engelmann. So often in Emshwiller's stories, you can have it the way you want it. She doesn't make you have it the way she wants it. For all her formidable wit, she is a kind writer. And a surprising number of her stories have happy endings. At least they do if you want the ending to be happy. I am not sure Mr. Engelmann is really the heroine's true love, but it seemed that way to me last time I read the story. It may seem quite different the next time. In 1990 came Carmen Dog, a novel about women turning into animals and animals turning into women, perhaps the funniest and the cruelest of her books, a sort of feminist Candide. The kindness of the innocent heroine, Pooch, triumphs over cruelty in the end, which is happy. At least it is if you want it to be. Even Pooch's children turn out well, setters and all male. Why this book isn't a feminist classic, I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe that's why people haven't heard about it. It should be a required text on gender in all high schools and colleges. I taught Carmen Dog in a literature class at San Jose State University in the spring of 2001. That is, I got permission to Xerox the first three chapters for the class, since Mercury House had let the book go out of print and didn't seem interested in the fact that we needed 15 copies. The class loved it so much that they demanded I get permission for them to Xerox the rest of the book, which they'd found several copies of. Teaching it made me see that it is better even than I had thought, and there is no cruelty in it. Truth, yes, and funny, Lord. After Carmen Dog came the stunning collection, The Start of the End of It All, in which both her range and her voice have widened, deepened. The comparison to Borges becomes inevitable with such stories as The Circular Library of Stones or The Haunting Vilcabamba. And so does the contrast with Borges. In Emshwiller's fables, while the invention is as magistral, the element of human pain is less distanced. And her humor is wilder than Borges's. The title story of this collection is a magnificent example of what happens to science fiction when a real feminist gets hold of it. It's about aliens coming to Earth, yes, but has nothing whatever in common with gooey-minded stuff like Close Encounters and E.T. The heroine, like most M. Schwiller heroines, is obliging and trusting and has very low self-esteem, being one of the rejected, the divorced, the growing older, the left out. An alien, or several of them, named Klimp, tricks her into giving birth to his, its, their offspring, a lot of tiny little fishy aliens, but her cats eat all of them but one. She keeps it and names it Charles after her father, or possibly Henry, and indulges in no more illusions about the aliens. It is a perfectly happy ending if you want it to be, or not at all if you don't, but either way it is extremely and profoundly funny. All right, so this was the Carol M. Schwiller I thought I knew, this kind, scary, funny, feminist fabulist. I picked LeDoit, Mercury House, 1995, off the new fiction shelf and stared at the cover. Not Queen Kong climbing the Empire State Building, not a bird-dog woman, nothing wild and imaginary, but a hand-tinted photograph of a very young woman in old-fashioned Western riding gear reading a letter in a desert. And the cover is a fair introduction to the book. LeDoit is different, as I said, from its author's other books and from most contemporary novels. It does belong in a certain fragile and discontinuous tradition of novels by or about women in the far West in the late 1800s and early 1900s. But first of all, I want to say that it is a love story. We tend to consider love stories as common, a simple-minded genre stuffing the romance shelves, rarely rising to art in the hands of a Bronte or Austen. But how many stories are, in fact, about love? I never asked the question till I gave a love story as an assignment to a writing workshop. From that group, I got 14 stories about lust. Next time I tried it, I got 11 lust stories, 2 hate stories, and 1 love story about a woman who loved her niece. Given all the kinds of loving we do, it's odd that we use fiction so often to explore love only as sexual desire or as an abusive, exploitive, or obsessional relationship, employing sexuality as a means to power. LeDoit is a love story. It's about the passionately fulfilled but never secure love of a married couple for each other and the passionately angry, rejecting love of a young girl, Lottie, for her stepfather, her mother, and her young half-brother. Family love, that voyage across a shoreless, uncharted sea of shipwrecks and sunken treasures. What a story it makes! How infinitely more interesting it is than any position Madonna can be photographed in! And how close such a story comes to the love life most of us actually live, the unromantic, endless adjustment and disappointment and readjustment, the blind cruelty and blind tenderness, the knots and complications and tangled nets, the rage and loyalty and rebellion, the ordinary passions of ordinary people trying to live with one another, trying to love one another. At the center of the story are LeDoit, the dirty, gentle cowboy who keeps trying to run away from his luck because he can't believe in it, and young Lottie, who sets herself afire and shoots a man and draws horses with mustaches that are portraits of LeDoit. LeDoit, who married her mother, Oriana. Oriana, raped by her respectable fiancé, ran away, came west, and had the daughter who's going to wreck the family and run away from her. A lot of the history of our country consists of people running away. It doesn't mean they weren't good people. Some of them. Then there's the setting. Those who live in the eastern half of the country tend to see cowboys on the range and ranches in the sagebrush as props for macho movies, not as the setting for a serious novel. You mean real people live out there? M. Schwiller's Sierra Slope, California of 1905 is far, far from Louis L'Amour and on another planet from Hollywood, but it's right up the road from Mary Austin's Land of Little Rain. This is one of the Americas where success has no meaning, a country of dryland farming and hardscrabble cattle ranching, where each loner knows the next loner. These are people with low expectations, tough, peculiar failures and runaways, desert people. In this impassively dangerous and beautiful landscape, human acts and relations take on the importance of any voice or gesture that breaks deep stillness. But Emshwiller doesn't rhapsodize desert life. She knows the country as a rancher knows it, as land, not scenery. She knows its people as individuals, not archetypes. She knows how to listen to its silences and theirs. My family on my mother's side, far westerners from the mountain and desert states, were people like these, and Emshwiller has them absolutely right. Young Lottie keeps a diary, which recurs through the novel. Reading it, I kept thinking of my great-aunt Betsy, born in Oregon in 1874. This sounds like Betsy, I thought. Betsy would have known this girl. Betsy was this girl. It's still a rare experience for a Westerner to find her people in fiction, to hear them talk the way they talked. There were women writers early in the century who knew them. Mary Halleck Foote, whose work Wallace Stegner appropriated without credit in one of his novels, was one. H.L. Davis's Honey in the Horn and Molly Gloss's The Jump Off Creek have an implacable honesty about Western place and character. Writers like Carolyn C., Judith Freeman, Deirdre McNamer, and Alison Baker are bringing this tradition up to date. At last, and slowly, and mostly by women writers, the West is being won. But Emshwiller, whose stories are so New Yorkish and sophisticated, who teaches writing at NYU, how does she know all about my great-aunt? By being a first-class novelist, I guess. Fiction writers do, after all, use the imagination, which is what makes them different from memoirists. Emshwiller knows the setting of her novel by heart, knows what life was like on a homestead ranch, knows what side you get onto a horse from. In a photograph at the back of the book, she's laughing as she hefts a businesslike saddle towards a handsome Appaloosa. But the background, trees or bushes, could be a creek bottom near Barstow, could be Long Island, could be anywhere. All I'm sure of is she knew what she wrote about in Ladoit, and it was worth writing about, and nobody else has ever written anything quite like it. I'm sorry to report that as of this writing, Ladoit is still out of print, and if you look it up at the place everybody thinks you have to buy books from these days, you may get what I got. The title Ladoit, but a description of a book about Belarus. So there we are again, up the Amazon without a paddle. I can only hope some publisher will have the sense to reissue Ladoit, a fierce and tender portrait of a girl growing up fierce and tender, a sorrowful, loving portrait of a man whose talent is for love and sorrow. A Western, an unsentimental love story, an unidealized picture of the American past, a tough, sweet, painful, truthful novel.